Hello and welcome to Sit for Speaks, the podcast for public finance professionals. In this episode, I'll be joined by Gamal Tarawa, or G as he likes to be known, who is the founder, managing director and lead facilitator for Purple Frog Connections. He was also a police officer in the Metropolitan Police for 25 years and will be one of the speakers at CITFA's upcoming AFEP conference. We're also joined by Mark McCauley, who is CITFA's counter-fraud manager. He talks about how fraud and corruption can be managed when it comes to public finance. And last, but by no means least, we'll be joined by Andy Burns and Ellie Roy, who discuss integrating care and CITFA's integrating care hub. Up first, we'll hear from G, who discusses his career as a Metropolitan Police officer. Listeners are advised that during this conversation, there are references to mental illness, racism and suicide, which may be distressing for some listeners, so discretion is advised. Gee, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. My first question is, you served in the Metropolitan Police for 25 years, during which you gave training on diversity, inclusion and personal development, and you were also the UK's first openly gay black police officer. You had an extremely successful and celebrated career with the police, so it would be great to hear about that career and some of the experiences you had as a police officer.
Thank you for the introduction. What I was just thinking there as he was speaking is that speaking about the police is great, but that's not the sum total. It's about what we bring to the role as well, and about our own awareness and stuff like that. So a lot of what I went through, part of it was what was happening, but the other part, the major part, is how I was interpreting and the challenges I was facing even before I came to the police service. And the police just basically magnified some of that stuff. I was taught to hate myself. I was taught to hate my colour. I was taught to be ashamed of my sexual orientation by the experiences I'd had in life prior to coming into the police service. The conditioning I'd had from growing up, for example, in a white foster family in a little village in Kent, where everything around me was white. And I was always taught, the condition I had is that there was a whole world that was going on and I wasn't part of it. And so that feeling of wanting to belong gets planted very, very early. And then everything in life becomes almost like, how do I find the place where I belong?
And do you think that you kind of took that into the police when you joined?
I took that into the police when I joined. I mean, because not only the police, I'd lived in Nigeria for a while. I'd lived in Harlesden for a while. So I'd gone from a white community to a black community, still didn't feel I belonged in that community. Went to Nigeria, was still didn't feel I belonged. And by the time it came to joining the police, I was desperate for a place to belong, to be part of. And that desperation puts you, and this is why when I talk about conditioning, this conditioning puts you in a place where, what do I give up to fit in? And what I gave up was my identity. Because by that time, I just really wanted to fit in. And when I first started in the police service, I was the one telling the racist jokes. I was the one who was going out of my way to stop and search black people as much as I could. You know, and things happened to me in that space that I allowed to happen because I wanted to fit in. I didn't want to be the outsider anymore. Ironically, it made me more of an outsider than I anticipated.
I mean, was there a point when, because you're kind of talking about wanting somewhere to fit in, but then even when you joined the police, said that you still didn't feel like it was somewhere you belonged. How did you carry that forward to such a long career?
I mean, the first thing is, I suppose, you know, as a young black kid, one of the things you learn to do is survive. You know, you learn to survive in a world that's not your world. So you try to do whatever you can, and it becomes almost second nature. Right? Unless you come to a point, and what happened for me is that in 2002 or so, I got to the point where I wanted to commit suicide because the pressure of that, a lot of that stuff, I didn't realize how much damage it was doing to me. And I think the other side is, yes, with the pressures of the police, there were problems, but there was also some intensely powerful moments. You know, there was experiences that you will not get anywhere else in any other profession. So, and I always say there's a distinction between the profession and the people. Right? There were people in the job that I didn't like. There were people in the job that had wrong attitudes. But the job itself, I enjoyed. The way I describe that, for example, you know, you turn up, you get to see humanity in its rawest form. You get to see, you know, vulnerability in its rawest form. And you turn up and in that moment, you just, people's masks, everyone wears a mask. And we got to see behind that mask. And that was a privilege. That was a real, real privilege. And I enjoyed those moments in the job. If that makes sense. So those are the kind of things that I suppose that kept me in, that realism.
How did it come about that you were giving the diversity, inclusion and personal development training? How did that kind of come about and what was that experience like?
I was working in the Department of Recruitment at the time in the early 2000s. And there was a lot of bullying that was going on in that department. And what the bullying did for me, it just brought everything that I was insecure about myself to the surface. All my fears about myself just came rushing to the surface. And it got to a point where I couldn't handle this anymore. And I decided I wanted to commit suicide. And I even got as far as writing the suicide note and leaving it on the coffee table. But fortunately, I didn't. Something stopped me. I don't know what stopped me or why. And then I had a breakdown. And I was off work for about three months or so. And during that 3 months, it was almost like I went on a journey into myself. And I had this point where I suddenly realized, oh my gosh, I don't know who I am. And I'm trying to be who I think people want me to be. And that was a real revelation. I was coming up to my 40s then. And I'm thinking, I still don't know who I am. And then I had to go on this, start this new path. Okay, I need to find me in all of this. And then when I started looking at that through the lens of racism and sexism and homophobia and stuff like that, I think, oh my God, this is what this stuff is all about. It's about how do we find our authenticity? How do we get valued? How do we belong? How do we feel in that space? And I came into back to work, and the diversity unit had just been set up as a result of the Lawrence inquiry, Stephen Lawrence report. And I went and joined the team. I applied and they took me, and I was, at the time, I was the only black officer on the team. And it just fit. It just seemed that this was, yeah, I could use what I'd learned in such a powerful way. I wasn't speaking from an academic perspective. I was speaking from a lived experience perspective. And at that time, a lot of money was given to the department, and they sent us on so many programs that you know, really made you look at yourself. And it was just what I needed. And, you know, hand, glove, together, they came and it happened.
Do you think that what I'm taking from your, like what you've just said and kind of reading about your story and kind of knowing a bit about the police as well, I think they have made changes and tried to learn from things that have happened in the past. But do you feel that now there is encouragement for people to speak up, encouragement for people, like, are there places to go for people to talk about problems if they have them, and are they encouraged to do so?
A lot more than when I first joined. Yeah, it's still a bit of a struggle for some people, but there is a lot more support out there than when I first joined. I mean, for example, you know, even with the diversity training, when I sit down and I talk to groups now, I see, you know, I came from a time where this wasn't talked about. Now we're given 3-4 days for us to talk through some of these issues. You know, there wasn't a Black Police Association or a Gay Police Association, or, you know, there was a Women's Police Association, there was a Christian Police Association, and there was the Federation, and that was it. So, you know, in the last few years, a lot has happened. The danger with all of that, though, is that what has happened, and the phrase I use, is that they've empowered diversity at the expense of inclusion. So they've said, you know, you can be A, you can be B, you can be C, and we'll help you be A, B, C, D, E, or F. But what they've not invested enough in is saying, but you're all part of the alphabet. So you've got people who've become empowered, but there's also, you tend to have this hierarchy of diversity, who's got the most pain, who deserves the most attention. And actually, all of us are hurting. Everybody's in pain on some degree or level. And it's about getting rid of the pain, not competing with it.
Do you think we have a problem with acknowledging these kind of problems and kind of facing them head on?
Yes, we do. And we do, because part of it is about the fact that I don't want to be seen to be that kind of person. And you have to face the truth to get to the healing. You know, you have to face them. And when we talk about any kind of discrimination, there's people go to the place of, you know, for example, if we talk about race, people talk, there's the malicious, nasty racism, and there's the unconscious racism, right? There's the stuff that I'm doing because I hate you, and there's the stuff that I may be doing because I don't know I'm doing it. People go straight to the malicious stuff. That's what they think you're talking about. And it's about, how do we have a conversation that's saying, this is not about blame or shame. This is about understanding. This is about opening our minds to actually how this stuff works. And the biggest barrier to that is denial.
And how do you think something like that can be overcome? I mean, do you think it's something that needs to be tackled in the police? And how do you think it could be done
in the police and then kind of in wider society and other sectors?
Well, I think in any organisation, whether it's the police, the public sector, the private sector, it's anything. It's first of all, we have to have a place where we can acknowledge that we all don't know everything, a safe place. We have to have skilled facilitators to help us navigate through some of that spaces. One of the sad things, or one of the most damaging things that can happen, is when you have somebody who says, right, we're going to do diversity, and they've never actually gone on the journey themselves. They don't even understand where they sit with it. And in some ways, what we've done, we've made diversity more about a business rather than about change.
You're now the founder and managing director of Purple Frog Connections. I'd love to know what kind of work you do there and how that came about as well.
How it came about, I worked in a place called Bram's Hill when I was in the police. And Bram's Hill is like a senior leadership college for senior police officers. And it was based down in Hampshire. And I did a secondment there, delivering diversity training to senior leaders. And while I was there, I was sent to a conference in Vienna to go and participate in this conference, which was great, fantastic. And I came back from that conference feeling, oh, that was nice. And then suddenly I got more offers from the people at that conference saying, could you come and talk at this place, or could you come and do a session? And I was like, oh, I'm still serving in the police. I can't do that at the moment. And then somebody said, well, why don't you set up a company and you can do it in your spare time, you know, as a business interest? And I thought, okay. So I set up the company in 2011. That's when the training started. And I was doing bits and pieces here and there. And then when I retired in 2008, or I say retired, I changed chapters. I like to put it that way. And when I changed chapters in 2018, I decided to do it full time. And it was going well. And what I do when I go into organizations, my work is about my strapline is creating space for courageous conversations to take place. So how do we talk about these issues without the blame, without the shame, without the defensiveness? And my role is to help people to get to that space where we can have open and honest conversations, where people walk away feeling hopeful rather than beaten up, where they feel, yeah, actually, I do want to know more. I do want to understand this a bit more. Or I even want to know more about myself. Because the first person you've got to look at is yourself.
Some of your work with Purple Frog Connections, I was reading about some of the kind of coaching that you do. And one of the topics was understanding privilege. So I was quite interested by that. And I just wondered what you cover in the training and what that kind of covers.
Privilege is what it covers. But it's about looking and understanding what privilege actually means. Right? You know, there's more than just white privilege. There's male privilege. There's economic privilege. There's religious privilege. There's able-bodied privilege. You know, there's so many different privileges, and it's about looking at what that actually means when we say privilege. The notion that a lot of people have, they think it's you're saying I'm better than you, and actually that's not what privilege is about. It's about saying there are some aspects of your life that you don't have to think about, that are not on your agenda when you walk into a room. You know, you don't have to walk into a room and think, am I the only X in this room, and what does that mean? Or, you know, when I'm applying for a job, I don't have to think about if I put my name on this form or what school I went to, will that have an impact? And so we talk through, I do a number of exercises around that to help people, a number of experiential exercises to help people to understand what we're talking about. And one of the exercises I use, which is very powerful, is I use right hand, left hand. And I say, imagine you're living in a world where everything is made for the right hand. Everything is made to cater to right-handed thinking. The only people that are not going to see that are right-handers. But if a left-hander comes into that right-handed world, they have to become ambidextrous to fit in. There is no pressure on the right hand to become ambidextrous to fit into a right-handed world. And that right hand can be from so many different levels.
From all the experiences that you've had, what would you want policymakers in this country to know?
That they don't know. Simple as that. Once you really know that you don't know, you stop making assumptions and you start engaging. A lot of times people are making decisions based on what they think should happen. There's a quote that says it's not what we know that causes us problems, it's what we think we know. And the only way you're going to do that is by engaging, talking. You know, I've gone to organizations, for example, and they will say things like, you know, I hear people say, well, you can't say anything nowadays, I'm scared to say the wrong thing. And I said, those statements are a sign that you work in a very undiverse environment. Because if you're working in a diverse environment, those questions wouldn't even come to the surface because you're dealing with it every day.
And do you think that feeds into, I mean, a bigger societal problem?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is starting because we're all human beings. So we all, one of the things we have to acknowledge, every single one of us has baggage. No matter where we work, we have baggage. The question is, how aware are we of what we're carrying? How aware are we of our baggage? And that's my, I mean, what I will say when I do my workshops, the first hour or two on the first day is about getting people to move their baggage out the way so we can actually start to hear each other. Because up until that point, everything I say to you is filtered through your bag of baggage. Until that gets out of the way and I get mine out of the way, we can't have a clear conversation.
And in terms of diversity and inclusion training in the workplace today, do you feel like enough resources given to that? Do you think the training is adequate, or are there things about it that you would change?
I don't think enough resources are given to it. And I think that's because it's not something that people can immediately see the results of. Right. You know, it's not it hasn't got a profit margin. You know, if you're going to invest in diversity, all the studies say if you invest in diversity, productivity will go up 50% or more. Now, people can't see that happening in the short term. So they look at it and think, well, I don't know how this is going to work. And I don't know. So I'll just tick a box. I look at it and I said, there's three levels of diversity training. There's, imagine a department store, right? So you've got the first level is what I call the window dressers. We know we need to do something, but we just want you to come in and just do an hour on a Friday afternoon. Right? And then we can say we've given our staff diversity training. And then if anybody comes in, we can say, yes, we've done diversity training. So that's the first level. Second level is we've got a department on the shop floor, a diversity department. So when people come into our company, we can say, oh, yes, we've got diversity. We've got a wonderful department over here that does it. They've got all the brochures, everything. They do all the work for us, and they ignore the rest of the shop. And then you've got the stockroom. And the stockroom is the place where all the secrets are. And a lot of companies and organizations spend more time trying to keep the stockroom door closed than they do going in there to actually get their sleeves up and work on it. The stockroom is where I like to work, because that's, if you get the stockroom right, it has an impact on the shop floor and the shop window. And it's getting people to understand that dynamic is the challenge. Sometimes people feel we have to do something, but we're not sure why. And I said earlier that if you want to do this work, you need to get qualified people in, and you need to be able to pay them. Because, you know, if you go in there and you're not offering, people have taken a lot of time to learn this stuff, get the skills, get the abilities. And you would pay an engineer, you would pay a software technician. This is in the same category. You know, it's even more important. You have to pay for the services and give credibility to those that work. It's not a question of we've done it on a Friday afternoon, that's it, we've done it now, let's go back to business as usual. That doesn't work.
The Met's had quite a turbulent time recently. They've entered special measures, and we've seen the resignation of Cressida Dick, who was the commissioner. What changes do you think that the force need to make going forward?
There isn't a one-size-fits-all solution, and there isn't a quick fix. If anybody's looking for a quick fix, they're living in cloud cuckoo land. This has to be a long-term, sustained initiative. Now, at the moment, we have a system that may not suit that initiative. You know, commissioners are there for between 5 to 7 years. It could take 10, 15 years to change a culture, and it has to be sustained, and it has to be. So it's going to be a big challenge for whoever sits in that seat, a huge challenge. And I think that one of the things, some of the things is there are lots of us who are willing to help with that. I was speaking to some ex-colleagues yesterday, and we were all sitting around talking about the fact that, you know, if they called us and say, can you help us with this problem, we would do it in a heartbeat. But the thing is, policing tends to look at things in short term, quick fixes. What can we do now? What can we do now? Not, hang on, there's a legacy, there's a future. We have to combine those two together to influence the present.
Do you think that's something about the nature of the work? Because obviously, when you're an emergency service, there are a lot of immediate problems, especially when you're on the ground. It's kind of all about what can we do in the moment, what can we do right now. So do you think that long-term planning or long-term funding should come from the top down, or do you think that that's a shift that needs to change amongst everyone?
It's amongst everyone, but it has to be authorized, has to be driven. You know, no matter what organization you're in, these projects or these programs have to be driven from the top. What I've seen is where the CEO or the chairman or the commissioner, we're trying to say, you will, rather than we will. We need to go through this, not you need to go through this. So it has to be, it's driven and motivated and implemented from the top, but it has to be pushed in at all levels, all levels. And it has to be done in a way that has credibility, because, you know, people will look at it as ticking the box. And if you're not doing it with credibility, what are you saying to the staff in your organization who do suffer from these discriminations, or who do, or are on the receiving end of some of this stuff? You're saying to them, actually, this is not really that important.
CITFA has their program, AFEP, which stands for Achieving Financial Excellence in Policing. And you will be speaking at the AFEP retreat in September. The Metropolitan Police is not the only police force. There's a lot of forces across the UK. Taking what we've just spoken about in mind, people who are in charge of the finances or achieving financial excellence in policing, what do you think they need to know about the situation?
That it's going to cost money. Simple as that. If you want to get this thing done properly, it's going to cost money. And I agree, you know, the thing is, I understand that there are competing priorities. But if you look at, you know, how much money is being paid out in compensation every year, if you look at that, that's millions. So if we don't do it, that will only increase. The investment now is to reduce those payments. You have to invest to progress. And also, you know, if you have that voice, if you can also be advocates for some of these issues in saying to chief constables or senior leaders, no, you have to invest in this. This should be a priority. Look at how far back do you, I mean, I'm almost 60 years old. This has been a feature of my life since I was born. 60 years on, we're still having the same conversations. You know, we have to do something radically different.
With everything that we've spoken about, is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know or that you wanted to discuss on the podcast?
I would say don't be afraid of the difference you can make. You know, this is, we talk about organizations, but organizations are managed, driven, energized by individuals. And it's the individuals with passion and dedication that make a difference. So don't be afraid to use your commitment, use your power, use your whatever you want to call it. Don't be afraid to make a difference. If you're in a position to do it, do it. Be courageous.
I think that's a great place to end. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
That was Gamal Tarawa, or G as he likes to be known, who will be one of the speakers at CITFA's upcoming AFEP conference. If you'd like to find out more about G or his company Purple Frog Connections, visit purplefrog-connections.com to find out more. Up next, we'll hear from Mark McCauley, who is CITFA's counter-fraud manager, who talks about how fraud and corruption can be managed when it comes to public finance.
Hi Mark, would you like to introduce yourself and tell our listeners about your role at CITFA?
Hi Mark, I'm Mark McCauley. I'm a senior consultant at CITFA, specialising in counter-fraud, working with public sector organisations in looking at how they tackle counter-fraud, offering support, guidance, advice and thought leadership on the subject matter.
Thanks Mark. So I know you're a big advocate for local authorities taking something known as a single citizen view. Businesses may call this knowing your customer. What do you mean exactly by taking a single citizen view?
My background is in local government. I've worked in London, predominantly local governments, for over 22 years in the counter-fraud function. And there was always an issue around when you're working in counter-fraud for local government in identifying risk, high risks, individuals that are taking advantage of the system, the services that they can get, the money that they can get, benefits, etc. And a lot of the time we would have to understand as part of an investigation what an individual gets from an organisation. So if an individual came up as a benefit claimant possibly working, we'd have to also understand what other services they get from an organisation in order to look at and capture the entirety of an offence, for instance. So where someone on benefits may also be working for the authority, for instance, they may be getting other services from social services, from grants, they wouldn't necessarily be entitled to. So there's always this big thing about knowing your customer, knowing your citizen and understanding what they get. And there was never a solution for, at a glance, you could see everything that someone might get from an authority. There are many, many services delivered by local government organisations. They are usually, even when they fall under the same directorate, they're usually separate departments that work in silos. They hold records, they maintain documentation and copies of documentation and information and data in ways that differ, that are not brought together, that are not easily accessible. So to give you an example, you might have someone in receipt of a grant administered by the local government, and someone in the grants function might have that in a system, you know, let's say some system bought off the shelf that stores all of the information in one place that they can easily access it. But that person might also be getting services from social services that the grant has actually been paid to them to pay for. But social services might maintain theirs in a different system, or even in a spreadsheet that doesn't match or doesn't, is never compared to or doesn't align with the original grants maintained system. So there's no way of knowing at a glance if your customer in the grants function is already getting a social service care package that the grant was meant for. A single view of your citizen, if you had that, I think I've called it a unicorn before, if you had that unicorn, if you had that system, that solution, that at a glance you could see every service that an individual was getting, you would understand what that person is doing, what they're applying for, what they're receiving, what they are registered for, signed up for. They could be registered on a housing waiting list and in receipt of benefits, and have provided a whole load of data that contradicts maybe the grant application or business rates or the other services that they get. And knowing and understanding your customer, having that single view of them, is so important.
So you describe that one view as a unicorn, and obviously the popular understanding of a unicorn is something which, you know, it's a mythical being and it doesn't actually exist. So does this system which you're referring to, that allows local authorities to have a single citizen view, actually exist? And if not, what else is there in place that local authorities can use to get the equivalent benefits of this single unified system?
I think organisations are a victim of circumstance. I can imagine if you were working for a local authority that has been around for many, many, many years, has historically dealt with paper documents, paper applications, and technology has evolved over time. And every time a new technology has come out and you've had the resources, you've implemented it in the relevant department that took priority. So over time, as an organisation, you've embedded multiple solutions in multiple departments that are individual, that are siloed, that they're not working together. And now you're at a stage where, in order to bring all of that information, all of that data together in one solution, has become increasingly difficult, because when you introduce individual systems, they don't necessarily look at future-proofing, aligning them for, importing and onboarding another system in another department. So the way data is captured would differ, the way the individual systems are used might differ, and when you try and bring all these systems together, they don't necessarily align. There's a massive piece of work. The unicorn doesn't exist, I think, because, or it would exist if you could start from scratch. If you could be, let's say, a brand new authority that hasn't got any customers, that hasn't got any staff, that you've got a person or a management team or, you know, a team that are sitting at the table going, right, we're going to build this new organisation. How are we going to control everything? How are we going to capture all of our data? And you would design a system fit for purpose from the beginning. That's how that unicorn gets created. And then everything after that is to a standardized format in a standardized structure that can be used in the designed way. What we've got, many, many solutions have been introduced. So what there is in the marketplace at the moment, what attempts have been made to bring together as much data as possible by having an umbrella solution that can pick up and import existing data set and look at matching them in a way that has appropriate logic, appropriate technology, algorithms, etc., that create entities. So me or you would be an entity. Our data might be stored differently in several different data sets, but this umbrella solution brings them together and it looks at all of the information or the data that can be used to bring those entities together. It's called entity resolution. And that gives you a snapshot of what your customer is doing across the data sets that have been ingested. But when you've got organizations that might have 800 different data sets and deal with hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of customers, then actually what you're doing is you're limiting your view, because you're only picking the dominant data sets with the, you know, as much information as possible for your needs. You're not going to bring all 800 in. That would be a monumental effort, monumental task.
Having an automated system in place that can link records together from various data sets, or indeed, as you said, other legacy systems, can help to identify and spot fraud, but it would also save the local authority time, money and resources. What about when the automated system gets it wrong? What kind of fail-safes are in place to stop innocent people being accused of fraud?
I think we have to be careful in using the word automation. I think the solutions that are being used at the moment are not automated in a sense that they're used to identify risks. They're used to look across the different multiple data sets and identify individuals, as I say, that have been resolved as entities that appear in more than one. And they would create a scoring, a system like a RAG rating, where someone might be, depending on the score, a high risk, medium or low risk. And that produces a risk report that will have a list of individuals that are getting multiple services that could contradict and could be instances of risk or fraud. And an individual, someone in an intelligence team or a counter fraud function would look at that data and they would do some deeper diving into the core raw data to see whether or not the information provided supports the risk that the fraud is being committed. When we talk about automation, that's a next level technology where you might have a system that automatically makes decisions. Now, you've got it in the banking world. If you go online and fill in an online application for a bank account, that system might automatically reject you because the information you've provided doesn't align with what they have found elsewhere, or that it might highlight that you're on a risk register already or have previously had an account and are not entitled to one, and it makes a decision. But when you're talking about public services, that next level of automation is much riskier. If you're going to introduce a solution that automatically refuses someone for benefits that they might need, that has got that political impact that there isn't necessarily the appetite to do yet. Local governments might not be willing to do that yet. And they might be willing to do it in some service areas. They might have a service area where the automated outcome isn't as high risk to an individual, and therefore they'll implement it. So when we talk about automation, we have to be careful. As it currently stands, there's human intervention, a decision-making process, and further investigation before anything, any service is withdrawn or any further action is taken. There's no real-time use of automation in decision-makings around fraud risks at the moment in local government.
Thanks, Mark. In November, CIPFA will be launching a major report into anti-corruption and counter-fraud. It draws on best practices from international examples, which have been really successful in countering and tackling fraud. In your opinion, what are the top three things that a local authority can and should be doing right now to mitigate the risk that they will be exposed to fraud?
Oh, that's a good question. For me, I mean, there are many, many areas that when we carry out our work, we look at to offer assurance to organisations that they're doing the right thing in their counter-fraud anti-corruption campaigns. I think having the right strategies in place to tackle fraud from the outset, in particular the prevention strategy, making sure that the organisation has a proven strategy that is adequately communicated across an organisation so that everybody knows what they're doing, that they can quickly respond to changes and threats, risks, etc. But not only having that strategy, that's been, you know, one of the areas, but having that support from leadership to embed that strategy into everything you do. That leads on to my other areas, one being the cultural change, that tone from the top. So one, accepting that there is the risk of fraud and corruption, making sure that integrity is paramount, that the culture of integrity is embedded in an organisation. Three, actually leading from the top, making sure that message comes from the chief executive officers, the chief finance officers, those that are leading, that show leadership, so that those at a lower level are more empowered to accept and follow those that and become embedded in that culture. Finally, for me, making sure that there's the appropriate training and mentorship, making sure that everyone who has a role to play in fraud prevention has the right tools, the right training, and at that practitioner level.
Thanks, Mark. That's been a really fascinating insight into what a single citizen view means for local authorities and how it can help them to spot fraud. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
That was Mark McCauley, who is CIPFA's counter-fraud manager. Next up, we'll hear from CIPFA's own Andy Burns and Ellie Roy, who discuss integrating care and CIPFA's integrating care hub. So I'm joined by CIPFA's own Andy Burns and Ellie Roy. Thank you very much for coming on at CIPFA Speaks today. So we're going to be talking about integrating care, which was the focus of one of the sessions today at Public Finance Live. So first of all, tell us about CIPFA's integrating care hub and why it's come about.
So CIPFA has had an interest in integrating care for a number of years now, and I think the Health and Care Act that passed in April this year allows us to refocus in that area across the board. Whilst the Act itself provides some new structures, mainly on the NHS side, but also emphasising the importance of local government as equal partners, it might not be anything new for some areas, but what it does is provide us another opportunity to add some impetus around that message. And CIPFA are committed to bringing together those partners from across the various different organisations with vastly different systems and trying to bring them together to develop a shared understanding of how they can collaborate with the ultimate goal of improving their population health and providing better value for money in their places. The aim of the hub is that it's a free policy hub, and we welcome those from the NHS, local government, voluntary sector. Clearly we have an interest in public financial management, but we welcome all players with an interest, and we hope to try and use the hub to showcase obviously our own work in this area, but also to try and speak to colleagues from across the sector to understand better what they want from us, but also to help us to identify best practice and challenges that they are facing.
If I can add, I guess the aim for the hub would also be whatever your interest in health and care integration, whether it's about the governance arrangements, the performance arrangements, the approach you take to about pool budgets or aligning your priorities, it's the one-stop shop. Whether you've got a health interest, a social care interest, public financial management interest, an audit interest, the first place to look is CIPFA's integration hub. And that will hopefully be a signpost to more information, advice and support.
Fantastic. So a good place to kind of share ideas then. And I'll just add that the Integrating Care Hub can be found on CIPFA's website. So to move on, I'm really interested to know what you both think the hub will do for integration and why it's important to bring these professionals across the sector together.
As I said previously, I think the finance and governance systems across local government and health are distinctly different. And although some areas have been working together collaboratively for many years and may have a better understanding, the new structures mean that others may be new to the arrangements. So the need to understand the partners that you're working with, I think, is key to the relationships that are fundamentally important to making integration work. And we have worked with HFME in the past to try and open the doors to breeding that shared understanding across the system.
Again, if I can add, I think whilst integrated care systems formally are new, you know, statutory in place from July, integration is not new. I've spent 25 years working in local authorities in the main at the health and social care interface. So there's lots of examples of historical partnership working, which is an attempt to be integrated in some of these services some of the time. So in addition to that rich history of examples of what hasn't, we've then got obviously a lot of new guidance from the NHS. And the hub will hopefully help, because it might help people navigate through the new advice and guidance informed by the history of what has worked well in some places and maybe what hasn't worked well in other places.
We saw a white paper on integration earlier this year that focused around what next after the 22 Act, and it looked at place. But what that demonstrated was that it actually asked more questions than it answered. So there are significant areas where issues need to be ironed out, and it's not going to be the same for every area, because by its very nature every area is different, because it's driven by local need or geography or structures. And therefore I think the hub aims to try and look at some of those issues that will be going on as time goes on, because even though the restructuring is happening now, they will evolve and develop over time. You know, this is not a big bang and it's the end of the game sort of thing. These questions will remain and need to develop over time as further functions are delegated to different levels, and other questions will arise as they start to work together more closely. So we see it as a place to have that conversation.
You just kind of mentioned something that I was going to ask about next, so that it brings me really nicely onto my next question. And this came across in the talk as well today, I thought, all of the talks actually, that there's an emphasis on place that was in the government white paper and in SITFA's briefing as well. So why is care at a place level so important to integration, and what will this mean for kind of local authorities?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think place is rightly, I think, at the heart of the integration approach, because actually this is about what happens on the ground, not just what's designed in Whitehall. Because the levers to improve health and wellbeing of populations about better housing and better education and better jobs, they are different in different parts of the country. So that focus on place and prevention to improve the health and wellbeing of the population, not just deal with the illness and care need of patients or service users, I think is really key. And what that brings in is local government at all levels who play hugely influential roles in dealing with those health and wellbeing challenges, both in public health in terms of prevention, in social care, but also the roles that local authorities play in those wider determinants of health. I don't think you can do it at the scale required at anything other than a place level, because the needs of the population, health and wellbeing in Dorset or Manchester or Merseyside or London or parts of London are very, very, very different. Whilst there are some similarities, there are many, many more differences. And I think the variation in places in terms of both their health needs, their population makeup, their history, their geography, their relationships means that one size can't fit all. We hear a lot about the NHS being a standardised national system, and now there are many strengths about having a standardised national system, but actually when you've got different health and wellbeing needs of populations who are very different, they can't all go through the same process. So I think place is, I think, the only way in which you can try and tailor the investment in health and care to meet the needs of the population residents that we serve.
Absolutely. And I think what one important addition or amendment to the 22 Act was what's known as the triple aim. It's like the three aims for the NHS. There was a late addition to add on a responsibility for health inequalities to each of those aims for the NHS. Obviously, as a result of the health disparities being highlighted throughout the COVID pandemic. And that really does open the door to that wider interpretation of integration as having a positive impact on population health and well-being, because you have to do that to start to address those health inequalities. And even within a system, you're going to see different types of inequality across different localities, different demographics. So places, if you like, the engine room to start to properly understand that and build the data up that is going to enable them to address that. And I think historically with integrated care, there has been a perception in 2016 when we had the Sustainability and Transformation Partnerships, a different acronym, there was a bit of a perception that it was very NHS-led, and local government in a lot of areas were there around the table, but they were always talked about as a single entity of local government. There wasn't that recognition of, you know, the upper tier and lower tier councils. And I think the focus on population health and health inequalities really opens the door again to start to engage with the boroughs and the districts, because they hold so many of the levers that influence population health and wellbeing. I would argue that they hold more of the levers than the NHS does, because if you get to the NHS, you're probably already sick. So it's a bit late to be taking a preventative approach to health and wellbeing.
And I think we've heard a couple of examples during the conference about practical local approaches to improve health and wellbeing. We heard from Jenny in the previous session about in Dorset, the people who were better able to access flu vaccines were the affluent and well-informed. But the people who would have got most benefit from getting the flu vaccine are some of the poorer people in the more deprived areas. So understanding the data to show that and then targeting it, that can be done locally. Yesterday we heard from Justine Greening in her plenary address about, in Bradford, this scheme called Glasses for Classes. So they spotted that educational outcomes for some children were poor, and they looked at the number of proportion of kids who had eye tests. And some of the poorer kids in the poorer schools had a much lower level of eye tests than the more affluent kids at schools. So they had a targeted approach, and actually that led to health issues being picked up and a significant increase in educational attainment. Now, you can't do that from Whitehall either. So I think that's why place is really important, because those practical bottom micro examples are ultimately going to be the thing that are going to improve the health and well-being of the population.
And it's that data that enables the proper evidence-based decisions to be taken that we need to enable good public financial management and good evaluation to happen, to make sure that we are doing the right things in the right places, directing the money appropriately and getting, you know, an impact back for that.
Definitely, some really good examples there. Another thing that I did want to talk about was the government white paper made quite a lot of lofty claims. It had quite a lot of big ambitions. Do you think they're expecting too much from the health and care sector?
I think it's right to be ambitious. I think the challenges about the health and wellbeing population need ambition. So I think that's good. I think the current situation that we're in, coming out of the pandemic and now with the cost of living pressures, significant elective care backlogs in hospitals, major pressures in adult social care still unresolved, and the prospect of further money further down the line. The danger is that the investment needed in health and well-being might get crowded out by the need to deal with the elective care backlog. So there's a here and now financial challenge and a longer term need to make different sort of investment decisions. So the ambition is great, but I think we're in a situation where in the very short term, we need to recognise that there are some short term issues and challenges, but actually we need to make sure that isn't all that we're focusing on. How do you have a twin-track approach which focuses on some of the long-term impacts on health and well-being at the same time of elective care backlogs? And as more and more of the health and care levy comes through and more finds its way towards, hopefully, social care and local authorities, we might be able to make more of an impact. But I think the real challenge is, in the here and now, how do we create sufficient headroom to make those investments which are going to have a long-term payback and are going to take a long while to come through? I think that's what we're worried about, and I think what we're trying to do with work at SIPFA is try and find examples where people have managed to do that sort of stuff and show that it can work to help make the case. Because prevention works in theory, intellectually, but actually when people are under pressure, we heard in the session, organisational sovereignty seems to trump the long-term need. But if you know there's a practical example which has shown actually it can work, I think there's more chance that people will think, okay, let's create a bit of investment to do that bit and then show we can do that at scale.
Yeah, we've done quite a lot of work on prevention before, and you hear the same thing in the face of the immediate pressures. It's the easy thing to turn off, to not do today, because it's a long-term investment and therefore you can put it off until tomorrow. But actually, the counter-argument to that is we wouldn't be facing the demand pressures now that we are seeing if we'd done that 30 years ago. So actually, we're just kicking that can further down the road. So as Andy said, that twin-track approach, yes, we have to deal with the here and now, but if we don't set aside some bandwidth and some investment to make services sustainable in the future, we'll be firefighting forever.
Yeah, and I think just to add one more thing, I think the creation of integrated care partnerships, which have local authorities as equal partners around the table in making those decisions about resource allocation, I think gives more chance of those investments being made. When it was just an NHS organisation talking about NHS pressures, they're going to point the money at the sort of the immediate, what's in front of you, NHS priorities. And I'm not trying to minimise the size and scale of those challenges, but if you've got round the table as equal partners, the local authority, the commissioners of NHS and social care, the voluntary sector, as we heard from in the previous session, with an equal voice and an equal say, I think there's a better chance, there's a better understanding of those challenges to make a better case for that preventative long-term investment.
Absolutely. I think the one other thing I would mention is it's a busy space at the moment, the health and care sector. So at the same time as we have, you know, the legislation passing and the changes coming through on integrated care systems, and as we've mentioned, the pressures on the elective backlog, etc., we're also seeing proposals for adult social care reform, most notably at the moment social care charging reform, which we have been waiting for a long time. I'm not suggesting we should delay, but we're also seeing, you know, the levelling up agenda, and as we've heard in numerous sessions across the last 2 days at conference, there's a lot of crossover there between levelling up and addressing health inequalities. And those are just a few of the policy papers that have come out in the last year. And even pre-COVID, both the NHS and social care services in particular were already facing massive pressures in terms of their workforce, increasing demand for service, and particularly in local government with adult social care, severe pressure on their budget. and those immediate pressures have not been given any additional funding since then. So I think we need to recognise that both sides are looking at budgets getting tighter with the cost of living crisis on top of that. It's a very, very busy playing field. And I think that perhaps if I had one ask from government or our new PM, when we know who it is, it's to try and bring together some of those policies and make them a bit more coherent, you know, join them up a little bit better and make them more translatable out to the integration agenda so that they can truly start to come together and work in that way and recognise more clearly what those shared outcomes are. Because I think at the moment the danger is that the competing priorities and the political pressures could actually add tensions into those conversations, which can already be quite difficult to have.
Just to build on what Ellie's point there as well, for me, SITFA and others in this advisory guidance space need to get better at making the connections between these various policy streams in this crowded landscape. So, for example, the integrated care system is not just about NHS and social care for older people and delayed discharges from hospital. Improving the health and wellbeing of populations contributes to levelling up. If you're healthy and well, in a good house, with a good job, you're going to be more economically productive and you're going to be on track contributing to the economy and society and paying taxes, rather than it's just being about adult social care for older people coming out of hospital. That's an important part of the integration landscape, but actually we need to be explaining that actually this is fundamentally important to levelling up as it is to health and wellbeing of populations.
And also, you know, both local government and NHS organisations are anchor institutions within the economy, so they themselves have a role in making a significant contribution to employment and the local economy in their area. So again, these are connected areas that we could be thinking about better.
Ellie Roy and Andy Burns, thank you so much for being with us on SITFA Speaks today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Andy Burns and Ellie Roy discussing Integrating Care and SITFA's Integrating Care Hub. That concludes this month's episode of SITFA Speaks. We'd like to thank all of our guests for giving us their time and we really hope you enjoyed listening. To find more episodes of SITFA Speaks, you can visit SITFA's website or you can find them wherever you like to listen to podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook for more, and be sure to join us for next month's episode where we'll have more interviews full of information that public finance professionals need to know about. Thanks for listening.